Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
It's another edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Lots to talk about in the way of earnings on this episode. We'll talk a little bit of L Brands. We'll also discuss QVC, which had flown under the radar until a big announcement last week. But we begin with Amazon. The retail giant and online giant reported their third quarter earnings Thursday after the opening bell, and results came in below expectations on profit, but exceeded expectations on revenue. And this is something we're going to talk about a lot during today's show, because it was a similar story for a number of other retailers where top line revenue, they were able to beat expectations, but margins weren't where investors thought they might be.
Yeah, and because of this, the stock price fell initially after this earnings release. Amazon's earnings per share came in at 52 cents versus expectations of 78 cents. So analysts expected a bit more on the profit side of things. Net income was $252 million, but if you compare this to the same period last year at $79 million for their third quarter, you can see that they are increasing the net income. Top line revenue came in at a whopping $32.71 billion versus expectations of $32.69 billion. So a small beat on top line revenue versus expectations there for Amazon, in part due to Amazon Web Services. Web Services keeps growing. It actually made up 9.8% of the quarter's revenue at $3.23 billion. So Amazon Web Services keeps growing year over year and quarter over quarter. Amazon Web Services has roughly 33% of the worldwide market share for cloud computing. And what's interesting, and as this relates to retail and e-commerce, is that Amazon Web Services is able to farm out their services and increase network capacity during the larger times of traffic during the last 3 months of the year. So they'll farm these technologies out to competitors, actually, to use their networking power as they're going to be seeing increased traffic through their different sales and promotions. So it's actually kind of interesting in that their competitors will actually be paying Amazon through a different service. So Amazon will only win either it is on their e-commerce side of things or their Amazon Web Services side of things. But if you look at their operating cash flow, Amazon was really pleased at the numbers. Operating cash flow increased 49% to $14.6 billion for the trailing 12 months, compared with $9.8 billion for the same period last year. As far as the e-commerce division goes, North American sales came in at $18.87 billion. This was actually below expectations too. So while the company overall exceeded revenue expectations, their e-commerce North American division missed them just a little bit. North American sales increased 26% for the quarter year over year. So you're still seeing, despite the miss for North American sales, a very large increase in sales. Sales were $15 billion last year. So that puts it in perspective that this year they had about $3.8 billion more in sales in their North American division. International sales for the company came in well above expectations, $10.6 billion. Again, this was actually seeing more growth than the North American segment. They saw sales increasing 28% for the quarter year over year. This compared to the 26% for those North American sales growth.
Amazon is interesting because they are such a multifaceted corporation, and we don't want to suggest that they are pivoting away from the e-commerce focus, because they're still finding ways to grow in the e-commerce realm. But a lot of deals and a lot of new things that they are rolling out have only tangentially to do with e-commerce. One of the examples of this is they have partnered up with Garth Brooks, and Amazon has announced that they will be the exclusive music service to stream Garth Brooks's music on Amazon Music. And Garth Brooks isn't someone that's adverse to making exclusive deals with retailers. In fact, just back in September, Target announced they have an exclusive collection of Garth Brooks music coming out in stores, and they're giving people a chance to pre-order that. So Garth Brooks has long kind of tapped into the exclusivity deals with retailers. And part of the reason is, apparently, according to a lot of sources, he's the number two best-selling artist behind the Beatles. One of the other things that Amazon has done during October is that they've released the all-new Echo Dot, which is a somewhat cheaper voice-controlled version of their device powered by Alexa. It's about $50. The normal Echo comes in at about $170 now. And of course, that Echo Dot is a way or is a conduit for Amazon to bring in more e-commerce sales because people can employ voice-activated ordering using the Echo Dot, and the commercials that they've produced certainly suggest that much. They're also tinkering with their Prime Photos feature, where now people can invite up to 5 family members to access what they call the Family Vault in their photo program. They increase storage for videos and other files by 5 gig, but a lot of these only have a slight connection to e-commerce, and therefore the question becomes, you know, Amazon has been this company that's been talked about for years, and certainly as long as we've been doing this podcast, is a major threat to some of the brick and mortar retailers. But other than Amazon's brick and mortar infrastructure that they've put into place to kind of facilitate picking up grocery orders, picking up produce orders, and that type of thing, it doesn't seem as though they're focusing a lot of attention right now on their generic e-commerce sales.
Yeah, that's right. But you see continued reinvestment. So for the previous 9 months, ended September 30th, Amazon actually invested $4.7 billion in infrastructure. And this infrastructure includes both distribution and web services. So you're seeing a lot of attention towards the Amazon Web Services sector of their business, but also for these distribution centers that are focused indeed on domestic e-commerce. So this is 30% more in spending than the same period in 2015. Where they spent $3.28 billion in infrastructure. Then also, not only that, you're seeing a build out as far as general merchandise sales is concerned. You're seeing them not really losing focus with North American sales when it's concerning electronics and general merchandise. And this includes grocery and digital devices, however, not video games or books. The sales for this category came in at $15.3 billion for their third quarter. And this was actually a 29% increase year over year. There was a lot of positive response from Prime Day, and this looks to have had an effect on that 29% figure. I think this figure would have come in much lower if they didn't have as much success as they did with Amazon Prime Day. So a lot of analysts and skeptics are saying that they may be losing a little bit of focus considering how profitable Amazon Web Services is. But you see the results from Amazon Prime Day, and I'm sure they're looking at this and saying, we're getting additional Prime memberships through this avenue, and we're getting a lot more merchandise sales that would not have ordinarily happened. People would be buying TVs on Amazon Prime Day. Perhaps they would be buying them at different retailers towards the end of the year, where you see these Black Friday promotions starting to pop up. So nearly 50% of their quarter's entire revenue was from these North American electronics and general merchandise sales.
And with a business like Amazon, when we talk about their e-commerce capabilities, we talk a lot about Amazon Prime. And something we addressed earlier this year was the renewal rates of Prime members. And one thing that has become clear for Amazon is that renewal rates are consistently going up. From 2014, when first-year renewal rates were around 81%, they currently sit at above 90%. And that's something that was reiterated during this particular earnings call. 2-year Amazon Prime retention rate has also gone up steadily over the last couple of years. And that's obviously a positive sign for Amazon. But the question then becomes, outside of infrastructure reinvestment and outside of reinvesting some of their money into different sources to make the entire e-commerce process more streamlined, where do they go from here? What are some of the different promotions they have to continue to bolster their e-commerce sales, which, as you mentioned, have been going up, but we're starting to see growth slow somewhat?
Absolutely. And I think some of the avenues that they have available to them is keeping on with the product selection. We talk a lot about their e-commerce product selection as far as where it sits when you look at retailers like Walmart. They have a far greater number of products available for their everyday consumer, and then even a larger amount for their prime consumer. So continue to seek out other services as well. As with that Prime membership, we talk about Amazon Music and things of that nature. But as far as the retail segment is concerned, they are looking at different ways to get into a different niche. So for instance, they launched Amazon Handmade in the European markets, where they're able to sell handcrafted items made by people in over 40 different countries. So even though that's going to be a smaller segment, Amazon is not trying to shy away from getting in anywhere they can and trying to get in and get a large market share with these niche markets. So I think they're going to be investing not only a lot of capital in those distribution centers to make it easier for customers to get their items at a faster rate, but they're also going to be having more items available at those distribution centers. I think that is going to be the prime differentiator in the years to come for Amazon. You see a lot of other e-commerce platforms. These different platforms are easier to navigate, similar to Amazon, and their mobile websites have been fairly good as of late with a lot of capital infused in those platforms. But overall, you're going to see Amazon really rely on those faster shipping times. You see 2-hour shipping, 1-day shipping. So all the same day shipping that occurs with these newer products that Amazon has, I think that is going to be the sole differentiator for them. And I think they understand that. You see the increased expense for shipping, Amazon has almost quintupled just in the last couple of years their shipping expense. And I think you're going to see more of that as they continue to build out their platform and procure leases on airplanes and things of that nature.
One of the more interesting storylines to follow over the next month or two with Amazon is how well they can do on Black Friday and the following Cyber Monday as well. Amazon actually did quite well on Prime Day overall, despite all of the social media unrest we talked about. But some of the analysts out there have been saying that the existence of Prime Day may actually hurt their performance on Black Friday or Cyber Monday. One of the benefits, though, for Amazon, in addition to their annual Prime Day, which we can assume they will do for a third year next year, is that they do have the benefit of having not only Black Friday, but also Cyber Monday to try and push out sales to their consumers. Their Prime Day UK site is already up this year, and I'm anxious to see how the company performs on Black Friday and Cyber Monday and whether or not they're poaching any of their own sales with their Prime Day promotion or if they're simply just benefiting from all three.
So as we stated, the stock did fall a little bit after this third quarter earnings release. The stock fell a little over 5% in after hours trading on Thursday. The stock was trading around $820 a share before the report came out. Now, as of recording this podcast, the stock is now trading around $770 a share. So you can see that it is a significant drop, especially if you just look at the price as a whole and not on a percentage basis. However, this still represents a fairly large market cap for Amazon. The company is valued at $363 billion, whereas if you look at Walmart, that company is only valued at around $215 billion, again, as of recording this podcast. Well, we move on from Amazon, which is an e-commerce powerhouse, to a brick-and-mortar off-price retailer in Tuesday morning as they reported their first quarter fiscal 2017 earnings last Thursday morning. Tuesday morning is an American closeout retailer specializing in medium to upscale home goods, seasonal merchandise, and fashion accessories. They have about 740 locations in the United States. They came in with a net loss of $8.9 million for their first quarter. Earnings per share came in at a negative 20 cents. However, this beat expectations of 22%. So this is actually representing a beat of about 9%, at least on the earnings per share side. However, if you do look and compare their revenue to last year's, they came in a little bit above. They came in with a 4.7% increase, coming in with revenue of $211.9 million over the same period last year. This would represent the fact that they are executing a little bit better on the supply chain front and getting products to their stores on time. Analyst expectations for revenue were $214.86 million. And they reported that they had 15 fewer stores to report income, therefore meaning that same-store sales were at a positive 5.1%. So that means they had higher revenue last year, but with a lower store base. This means that the stores themselves performed well. And if you compare those same-store sales to 2015, during the same quarter, they were 3.6%. So they are increasing quarter over quarter, year over year. And this is good news for Tuesday morning. But the question for Tuesday morning going forward is, can they be profitable and can they get over this supply chain hurdle?
We talk about Amazon putting infrastructure investment forward, and that's something that Tuesday morning has been trying to do. You mentioned these new distribution centers having these supply chain problems, though, really holding back overall revenue from this quarter. Another thing that Tuesday morning often does, and it's something we touched on about 6 months ago on the podcast, is they're constantly reinvesting and trying to reinvigorate stores, move stores from retail districts that are perhaps forlorn or downtrodden and move them into newer retail districts. They're looking at more of a high income or at least a middle to upper class income level that they're marketing to, especially now with the increased popularity of off-price retail. It's interesting to note that Tuesday morning, one of the few off-price retailers that aren't turning a profit, we talk about TJX and Ross quite frequently on the podcast and how popular those two stores are doing. Tuesday morning at a bit of a disadvantage because they don't have as much in terms of the apparel side of things, but they are working on reforming their image. They've adopted a new logo, new coloration on the logo as well. In fact, their old logo, and it might just be the existence of the word Tuesday in there, but they essentially used the same serif font as Ruby Tuesday did. The color was red. Now they have changed it to a green, almost a teal color. So an in color certainly, and a nice clean sans serif script font there as well. So a nice looking new logo for Tuesday morning that they've just rolled out, and they're starting to rebrand some stores with those new logos as they close underperforming stores and move them or open other stores altogether. As you alluded to, they had a net store loss during this last quarter, but in terms of the overall positive outlook on Tuesday morning, or whether or not the outlook should be positive on Tuesday morning, I'm not sure that store count is the best measure for them. As you mentioned, they've got to fix those supply chain issues, and they've got to get things worked out as far as stabilizing their infrastructure investment. I think we all agree that it's a good thing when you invest in your infrastructure, but their cash on hand is dwindling a little bit. Their cash on hand has gone down significantly quarter after quarter over the last year. Gross margins did increase slightly quarter over previous year's quarter, from 35.9% on their gross margins to 36.5%. But their SG&A expenses did rise to $86.6 million. So they're having issues in terms of execution there. And as we mentioned, they're still coming in with a loss per share, negative 22 cents, which was still a beat on earnings per share, but their stock price did go down somewhat after they released earnings. So they need to go forward with some sort of a concrete plan about how they are going to continue to invest in their infrastructure, to move their stores, to close underperforming stores and open others up, or to remodel current stores to their new image, all within a certain budget such that they can turn this around, stop losing their cash on hand, and eventually maybe turn a profit for shareholders.
Yeah, and you talked about selling, general, and administrative expenses. That percent actually, as it pertains to revenue, increased for the quarter. 40.9% versus 38.9% last year. That means they aren't operating as efficiently as they could. And I think that could be due to what you had kind of mentioned with the store relocation and new openings that they had during the quarter. That is going to be fairly expensive. As a lot of people understand, whenever you close down and open a new location, it's going to be fairly expensive on the overhead side of things. You need additional store employees to help stock the shelves and to move operations. They also are expanding some of the stores. They expanded 8 stores for the quarter, making them a little bit larger so they can carry a bit more inventory and product selection in those locations. So overall, they did speak of IT investments as related to actually the in-store experience and not necessarily just the distribution and supply chain problems they had been having. They want an easier experience for the management of these particular locations. They feel like a better inventory system at these individual locations will transfer over to make things more streamlined through their distribution network. So whenever they sell out of an item, they can replenish it at a quicker rate through these IT tools. Also, you look at their merchandising, advertising, and product selection going forward. Their president and COO, Melissa Phillips, said that their areas of strength are most notably in seasonal, and they're looking towards the next few months as great opportunities for customers to come in and experience a more broadened product selection. We all know also that seasonal items tend to carry higher margins, so hopefully they will be operating at a little bit better margins through the next quarter. They said also that they've had several opportunistic buys in the quarter, noting that they are a discount retailer, and so they're looking always for different buys, wholesale buys, so that they can pass those savings on to their customers at a lower price point. So they're trying to compete on price at their brick and mortar locations. Something I did want to note that we had talked once previously about in regards to Tuesday Morning is the fact that they do not have an e-commerce site. TuesdayMorning.com does exist, but it exists strictly for the investor relations and just to see their paper advertisements. So whenever they have a weekly or monthly advertisement, they do roll that out on TuesdayMorning.com, but they don't talk about other items more specifically. They don't have price points. Instead, they just have a store locator where they recommend you just going to that brick and mortar location to look at the product selection and their pricing. So I think this is going to be a problem going forward. You talk about the competitive nature of Amazon. The types of products that Tuesday Morning has are those directly in line with those big e-commerce competitors. This is going to be a problem, and I think they should potentially look at reigniting their e-commerce operations that they had shut down in August of 2013. While this would be another burden on their supply chain, I think to compete for the long term, you're going to have to help gain some customer loyalty by having some direct-to-consumer options from Tuesday Morning's site. You do see a lot of good deals at their brick-and-mortar locations, but a lot are considered one-time deals. These are just one-time buys that Tuesday Morning buyers have bought, and it would be a little hard to implement that in terms of an e-commerce site, but I think this is possible, and I think this is something they should look at further down the line, again, if they do get profitable and see some positive cash from operations.
And that's the key. They've got to be profitable first. And that's just another infrastructure expenditure for Tuesday Morning and a significant one when we talk about other retailers doing the same thing, pouring money into their e-commerce operations. I had a couple of things I wanted to note before we moved on, which is that they are implementing a new planning tool to make sure that each store's inventory flow on a one-by-one level happens to be optimized. The second is we talk about these supply chain issues that they've had. One of the positive signs for Tuesday Morning, and it is something that their COO, Melissa Phillips, happened to mention in the latest earnings call, was that they have had a number of what they consider to be solid buys, and it seems like they're getting the kinks worked out of their supply chain, at least on the buying end. Their inventories went up by $80 million overall from June 30th of 2016 to September 30th of 2016, where now they have $323 million tied up in inventory. In some cases, we might say that's a bad thing, especially for an off-price retailer that prides themselves on a quick turnaround. But here you're getting ready for the holiday season. And we look at last holiday season, they just at this point had about $270 million tied up in inventory. So a significant increase, and they feel like they are well positioned to go into the holiday season with the shelves full, which is one of the keys for off-price retailers as you head into the holiday shopping campaign. Well, on to Lumber Liquidators, who also released their third quarter results over the past week. The stock fell over 13% on Monday after investors didn't necessarily like what they've seen. But this seems to be a circumstance where Lumber Liquidators performed well, just didn't live up to analyst expectations, which may have, in fact, been unrealistic given the lawsuits that Lumber Liquidators is tied up in. They did beat analyst expectations on top-line revenue, and same-store sales were able to tick up just slightly from the previous year's quarter.
Revenue came in 3.4% higher than the previous year, where they had revenue of $236 million. That scare from the formaldehyde in the flooring actually was first coming on in the beginning of 2015. So you're really comparing quarters that had already seen some losses as far as the revenue side of things. Profit is what disappointed Wall Street, with a net loss of $18.4 million or 68 cents per share. Analysts had expected a loss of 19 cents per share. Last year during the same period, they had a loss of 31 cents per share. So overall, you're seeing an increase of loss quarter over quarter and year over year. But there are some bright spots with Lumber Liquidators. A lot of people have to recognize that these types of things take time. There are a lot of costs associated with trying to settle numerous pending lawsuits. You're paying a lot of lawyers and you're just tying up a lot of cash and other things than your operations of your store. So if you look at the bright spots and look at the second quarter of this year, which not a lot of media outlets have talked about, net sales in the second quarter were $238.1 million, a decrease of 4%. Again, this quarter they had an increase of 3.4%. So you can see that they're already improving operations. Again, on the last quarter, they had a same-store sales decline of 7.2%, reflecting a 0.7% increase in the average sale, which was fully offset by a 7.9% decrease in the number of customers invoiced. You compare that to this quarter, where same-store sales, as you had alluded to, are up 1%, and there was an actual increase in traffic, which means people are no longer getting scared off from the formaldehyde scare in 2015. And so you see the uptick in traffic compared to last quarter, and you're seeing an uptick in traffic year over year. So this is really good news for Lumber Liquidators. And if you're a shareholder, you should have been pleased with this quarter. However, again, the stock was down about $3 a share since they announced these earnings, and the stock price is still near where it was at after the time of this release. So you look at these increased gross margins too, another bright spot, up 4.3% year over year. The company had a gross margin of 31.4% in the third quarter, compared with 30.1% in the prior year period. And so this is one of the things that really differentiated Lumber Liquidators on the financial side of things. People were really bullish on Lumber Liquidators because of those gross margins. They were buying a lot of Chinese flooring that carried higher margins, and the worry was, as of recently, you wouldn't be seeing increased margins because they're no longer getting flooring from these same manufacturers. And so you see these gross margins increase, and this is a very positive sign. This is a sign that they can be profitable. After Lumber Liquidators has finished all of these outstanding settlements and lawsuits, you would think that this company can be profitable again. So again, a lot of bright spots despite the profit miss for Lumber Liquidators.
You hit the nail on the head when you were talking about gross margin. The expectation was, in fact, that gross margin might decrease now that they are paying such close attention to the sourcing of their flooring and now that they're potentially sourcing flooring from higher cost locations. But it hasn't. As you mentioned, it's gone up 1.3% from 30.1% to 31.4% in the third quarter of this year. So margins beat analyst expectations, top line revenue beats analyst expectations, and same store sales are up 1%. So why are analysts disappointed? Well, oftentimes analyst consensus estimates are very, very accurate in forecasting a store's growth and forecasting what a store will look like when they deliver quarterly earnings. But in this case, when you look at the analyst expectation of loss per share, they expected a loss of 19 cents per share. Lumber Liquidators, despite all of these things that they're succeeding at, still showed a loss of 68 cents per share. Why were analysts so far off? Well, the reason lies in selling, general, and administrative expenses. You talked about how they went up in the third quarter of 2016. They went up by about $12 million compared to $88.3 million in the prior year's third quarter. Part of this is from additional advertising, and that's something that Lumber Liquidators signaled they were going to have to do to start to win customers back during the last quarterly release. So this shouldn't have caught analysts off guard. They spent $3.5 million in additional advertising across multiple channels, television, radio, newspapers, endorsements, just about everything that's out there. In addition, they're still seeing costs from these pending lawsuits, and you're going to continue to see that over the next few quarters. So I think this is a circumstance in analysts almost universally across the board expecting that these legal fees or that these advertising fees wouldn't be as severe in this last quarter, which in some cases you could make the argument that that's an unreasonable expectation for a company that's been run through the legal ringer like Lumber Liquidators has. So it might be a circumstance here of analysts just needing to readjust their expectations as far as the legal fees and as far as those selling, general, and administrative expenses, because Lumber Liquidators is performing well on gross margin. They are performing much better on same-store sales, and they are absolutely exceeding all revenue expectations.
I would expect to see these lawyer fees come down in the following months and quarters to come. You see how they settled with the Consumer Product Safety Commission and the U.S. Department of Justice and the California Air Resources Board. You also saw them settle with several civil suits. However, they are still under investigation by the SEC and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Virginia. So they have a lot of pending lawsuits, so don't expect lawsuits to go away entirely, but potentially the lawyering and those kinds of fees associated with these lawsuits will be coming down slightly. On September 9th, management announced a new round of senior management appointments, and they're going to be focused on trying to improve their financial status as well as improving product pricing competitiveness. They appointed new CFO Martin Agard, who has 30 years of experience. He's known as being a very disciplined finance chief and a turnaround expert. And also Christopher Thompson, who is appointed senior vice president and chief information officer for the company. He will be focused on modernizing internal systems and streamlining processes throughout their supply chain, which will in turn reduce costs and bring them to their goal of keeping those gross margins a little bit higher. Again, these appointments are fairly recent. In September is when this happened, so there was a lot of opportunity to grow from these appointments, and it will take about two or three, maybe even four quarters to really see the renewed position in the market. Again, we talk about how the stock price had dropped. The stock was trading around $18.75 before the earnings release, and the stock price is now around $15 a share. While volatile, the stock has been trading upward for the past year, as high as almost $20 a share just in the past month. The 52-week low is $11 a share, so they're still about $4 ahead of that 52-week low there, and they currently have around a $340 million market cap given their current valuation.
When we transition from earnings calls to digital media and digital media marketing, as the home shopping network QVC is attempting to grab more millennials, and they're doing so, or trying to do so at least, by starting up a new television channel. The new channel will be called Beauty IQ, and it will go to 40 million U.S. homes beginning this month on multiple different satellite and cable providers. So the obvious question here is, how many people still know that QVC exists? How effective is QVC's existing business model underneath Liberty Media, its parent company? And the second is, can they make this particular model work? Because it's not just about trying to sell products to consumers. They'll have a lot of beauty-centric shows on there as well that might make it a bigger play among millennial subscribers.
It's going to be a little bit different of a play for QVC, because they will have those beauty-centric shows that they won't be live. They won't be live shows selling products that they have on their website. Instead, they're going to be having shows all about anything to do with beauty and fashion. So this is going to be interesting for QVC, because they hadn't really done this previously. So There is a little bit of skepticism surrounding this announcement, but overall, if you bring in the amount of experience QVC has selling on TV, they've done so for over 30 years, and they've been very profitable at it. If you look at their existing market, they typically sell things in the fashion industry. They don't have a lot of beauty products. However, they said that beauty products accounted for 17% of its overall revenue last year. Again, QVC is a privately held company, so we can't really delve into the numbers too much. We just have to take them at face value. So this isn't really a core offering and hasn't been for quite some time, but they are looking towards these beauty products as having a higher margin. And you can see this as evidenced by the Sephora and Ulta Beauty same store sales and these positive earnings reports coming from this sector overall. You're seeing that makeup and beauty supplies has really taken off here domestically, and to see brick and mortar growth just so good in this space is really telling. So even though people aren't really subscribing to cable as they were in the past, I would say that QVC is definitely on to something here, and they're really pushing their online interface as it relates to this channel. They're saying that pretty much everything they're offering on TV and everything that they're promoting will be available online. A lot of customers would like to actually watch a TV program, maybe selling a particular piece of merchandise, and then stream while they're watching it on their tablet or smartphone and then purchase from there. So this is really smart by QVC management. They're really looking ahead, and this ties in with their overarching mission of attracting millennials to the QVC platform.
We've seen, as you mentioned, all of this brick and mortar growth for beauty products out there. And what QVC is doing is investing not only in the television channel, but as you mentioned, in some omni-channel platforms to attempt to sell these different products. And that's one of the benefits for QVC is now, over 5 years ago, it's much easier to get linked up with certain streaming services like Roku, for example, as well as offer the same content and video platforms live online on their own website. QVC is a little bit different from most cable companies. Both QVC and the Home Shopping Network, or HSN, have a deal where they actually pay cable companies in order to be aired on their cable systems. The same thing goes for satellite fees. In fact, they tend to pay upwards of about $3 per year per subscriber in what they call revenue shares. This is in contrast to a company like ESPN, whom satellite and cable companies will pay over $5 per subscriber to make sure that they can deliver ESPN to their consumers. So in this case, there's actually money going in the other direction for the shopping networks. So the fact that there may be, in a few years, fewer cable subscribers might actually be a good thing and save on the bottom line for Liberty Interactive and QVC. So this could be a benefit in the long term. Although, based on Comcast's latest earnings and based on some of the subscriber numbers out there, it seems like the number of overall cable subscribers has remained relatively stagnant, but it may not in the next 2 to 3 years, and that's something that QVC seems well prepared for. In addition, with the digital transition for over-the-air television, one of the things that's overlooked is that QVC, in addition to reaching cable and satellite television subscribers, they're also reaching a healthy amount of over-the-air television users as well. Most major markets in the United States have an over-the-air QVC program. It's usually in standard definition, usually 4x3 format, but still, they're able to reach those even after they've cut the cord through local television programs. In addition, they're able to reach people online. So this might be a good investment overall for QVC, noting that they've seen a big boost in beauty sales, not only through themselves, but noting businesses like Ulta who have seen beauty sales go through the roof. It is also worth noting that QVC also has outlet stores in the United States as well. So they are starting to get into brick and mortar. And I'd be anxious to see if perhaps they do have plans in the works for a Beauty IQ retail store or a Beauty IQ outlet to maybe breach into the brick and mortar sector in addition.
Yeah, I would imagine those stores would be a little smaller, and they would probably not expand too fast considering they aren't really too deep in the brick and mortar space. But if you do look at their content and look at their programming that will be available, it will have a lot of online reach. Consumers will be able to view through the QVC app and a simulcast on Facebook Live. So they're trying to take advantage of those social media outlets. They're also going to be using YouTube as a key tool for additional video content. So you can go on YouTube and view videos and other selling of different merchandise that you would not see on this Beauty IQ channel. If you look at a quote by Mike George, their chief executive, he says, "We think we can continue to expand the base of people who view us on broadcast." And I think that really ties into what we're saying here with this digital content. I think they're really bullish, not only on the cable subscribers sticking around for the long term, but for those subscribers that aren't, they're going to have something for them as well. So they're really trying to get in any space that they can. And again, anything with beauty products as of late really does carry some good margins. So they want to get in on that while they still can. You don't want Sephora and Ulta Beauty to really take advantage of their omni-channel networks and get that market share before it's too late. So overall, if you look at QVC, there is a risk of customers watching these promotions on this channel and then doing price comparisons on these competing websites. And I think that's something they're really hoping won't happen. And I think they're trying to tie people in to their website. And you see that more and more. If you watch a live QVC broadcast now, they really do promote their website. And they're trying to get that traffic to their website to get people to buy not only the products that they're advertising there live, but other like products as well. So they have a lot of different partnerships lined up. And I am curious to see where this goes in the future, not only with this rollout, but as you said, if there's any brick and mortar expansion in the years to come. As of the data we could dig up, 2013 U.S. sales for the company were $5.8 billion. Again, this is part of the larger Liberty Interactive conglomerate, and I would not be surprised to see this number almost doubled, taking on a beauty segment that has just exploded here in the United States.
And one other thing we should note, even though there was a lot of cynicism in the media and on some blogs about do people still watch QVC, do people still purchase items from QVC, they actually brought in 2005, just in the QVC branch of Liberty Interactive, $8.7 billion. So they're still seeing certainly some success, and that's remarkable considering their overhead where they do broadcast 24/7 and they have to have not only the on-air talent, but also the people working behind the scenes in order to make sure that that happens, just on the television aspect. That's before we get into their omni-channel infrastructure.
Well, we move on to our last story of the day. This concerns L Brands, which has revised down sales and comps for the next quarter due to sluggish sales over the month of October. This actually came ahead of its investor update meeting that happened on Tuesday of this week. The meeting was held to talk to analysts and shareholders about the expectations going forward for the company and the overarching strategy that they hope to implement. We've talked previously about L Brands taking away the Victoria's Secret catalog, which has been very well known, and their swimwear division. And this comes as a restructuring hopes to bolster sales in the latter half of 2017. Overall, same-store sales for the month of October came in at a positive 1% for the company as a whole. But if you look at their two different sectors, Bath & Body Works and Victoria's Secret, one far exceeded the other. Bath & Body Works is looking to be the major growth area for now through L Brands, as October same-store sales came in at 6%. However, the negative came from Victoria's Secret, as they had negative 2% same-store sales for the same month. So overall, even though Victoria's Secret is still the heart of the business revenue-wise, it appears as though they are losing a little bit of grip on that strong brand.
L Brands is one of those that we talk about on a regular basis simply because they do have multiple important mall-based holdings in the United States. We talk about Bath & Body Works and Victoria's Secret both on a regular basis. But I think the major story coming out of this earnings call is the fact that Les Wexner wants to pivot the overall direction of their store brands as a whole. The MO for Victoria's Secret and Bath & Body Works, as far as getting customers back in the door, customer retention, has been mail or email coupons out to customers that are on their mailing list. Oftentimes a buy one, get one free, or buy one item and get a completely separate item free in both store segments. But he mentioned that they wanted to make major changes and go away from that model, saying that it kind of degrades the overall value of their brands. And while this might be true, earlier this year we covered the fact that Victoria's Secret was doing away with their catalog and that they wanted to reinvest that money. They had mentioned that they wanted to reinvest the money into things like other forms of marketing through the mail, and now they're taking that away too. So you have to wonder, where is the reinvestment going to come from L Brands to boost both Bath & Body Works up and Victoria's Secret up? Over the last year, we've seen this cycle where if Victoria's Secret has success in one quarter, Bath & Body Works lags behind, or the opposite is true. What does L Brands have to do in order to make both stores, both outlets succeed at the same time?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think right now the focus seems to be on Bath & Body Works with those favorable comps. But you look to the strategy of Victoria's Secret right now and you get just a little confused because you're looking at them taking away their catalog business and then them now saying that they should have dismantled their coupon business a little while ago. So you're looking at these coupons and you know, you don't want a company to use these as a crutch, but overall, this brings in a lot of traffic to their stores. Typically, you would get one free item every so often, and you would get a certain percent off through these coupons and these mailing offers. Them saying that they want to do away with these coupons will hurt traffic in the short to midterm, in my opinion. And I think if you look at their products, they're coming out with several new products, but they're saying that store-wide markdowns will be the key to keep customers coming into their stores. But I really think strategically, this is going to be hard to convey to your normal customers because while you may have customers that come into Victoria's Secret every month or so, it's going to be hard to market these markdowns when you don't have a catalog business and you don't have these coupons coming in the mail anymore to advertise the normal pricing of their store products. So I think there's going to be a lot of questions to be had in the quarters to come. But again, management relayed the idea that these markdowns and product investments would pay off by the end of 2017, seeing positive same-store sales growth of about 7 to 10%. However, they're saying that the next couple of quarters will be very trying. They're going to be seeing potentially more negative same-store sales from the Victoria's Secret side of the business. But given their confidence in brick and mortar, it seems as though they do have to come up with something that will stick. And it can't just be something that lasts for a couple of quarters. They've had a very good run up to now, but seeing as they have such a large store presence, they really have to keep that traffic up. And I am curious to see if their sales during the holiday season are what they expect them to be. Overall, you see competitors such as Lululemon come in to their space with athleisure wear. And I think this is going to be a trend that won't go away anytime soon. And to see Victoria's Secret pounce on this would be a very big positive for them.
So L Brands is one of those rare businesses that actually breaks down same-store sales on a month-by-month basis. And you see the last few months for Victoria's Secret being either even or negative here in 2016. And that's compared to back in June, they showed a positive 6% in terms of same-store sales. The last few months, however, for Bath & Body Works, they have been certainly outperforming expectations. They saw same-store sales growth in September alone of 9%, and that was against tough comps from 2015, where they also saw same-store sales growth of 9%. And then in the previous year, in 2014, they saw same-store sales growth of 10%. So Bath & Body Works, as well as the White Barn Candle Company, which is kind of a brand extension based off of Bath & Body Works, they have really seen some success during the fall and winter months over the past few years. The question is, can they keep that going into the final quarter? And what's more, can they continue to keep that going in the future by taking away some of the customer retention programs like the free product mail outs and that type of thing? Can they maintain the strength in terms of same store sales? But it seems as though, based on the things that they've released, not only in terms of their webcast, but also their sales release and the quotes that were in the latest press releases, L Brands knows what they don't want with Victoria's Secret. But as you mentioned, they haven't really specified anything that they want to jump into. the athleisure wear industry would be certainly a great start for them. But this is one of the things where Les Wexner, who originally founded the company back in 1963, it seems as though many of his quotes have been on the more reactionary side. And I don't know that anyone is questioning whether or not he knows what he's doing in his role. He's obviously brought the company to prominence over the last half century, but it does seem as though L Brands on the whole has become a little bit more reactionary in the way they address things. And we see that with the elimination of swimwear at Victoria's Secret, which is a high margin item. They got a lot of backlash on social media for that adjustment. They got even more backlash for doing away with their catalog. And now you have to wonder, how will they market themselves in the future other than through their traditional challenges? And how are customers going to react when you take away those deals, when you take away coupons and customer retention initiatives? JCPenney went through a similar thing some years ago, and we learned very quickly that customers don't like it when you take away their sales. You have to ease them into it. So it's not something that they can eliminate overnight, because otherwise they'll see a drastic hit on their top line revenue.
Yeah, and I think you really saw a distraction away from their domestic business later on in this investor update call. They started speaking about their major growth in international sales and the opportunities that lie overseas. They were saying that China has millions of dollars of potential. And right now they were saying that resold products, products bought and then resold in China, makes up millions of dollars in revenue every year. So they plan on selling on Alibaba's Tmall platform in the coming year. And they also said that they're going to have a presence at the Paris Fashion Show to reignite these European markets, and also a potential showing at the Shanghai Fashion Show next year or in 2018. This was alluded to by the management there at L Brands. And I think that this is going to be something that really ties into the future of their company. A lot of questions have been raised about their performance and strategy here in the United States. And I think that it's not only going to be a distraction, but a legitimate question about the business. How are they then going to market to these international markets? Is it going to be the same as they've done through the past couple of decades here domestically? So they're looking at China as a close number one in future sales. So that right there tells you that they're not going to be as focused structurally on the performance of these U.S. locations. So there are going to be a lot of questions surrounding this in the future, but if they can keep that revenue high and then have increased operating margins overseas, this really will be good for shareholders in the long term.
International growth is something that they touched on in their last investor handout, but one of the things that was somewhat lacking was a future direction for certain things. Other than establishing that Victoria's Secret is the global brand leader in terms of lingerie, other than establishing that Bath & Body Works is one of the, as they put it, largest specialty retail beauty brands in the world, they didn't really have specific goals in terms of retailing. They mentioned that they'll achieve growth through international sales and through online sales, but they didn't mention anything as far as what they're doing to assist in the brick and mortar as far as new products or in terms of product underscoring. And since this investor handout came out, they've actually reduced their overall number of product lines. So it's going to be very difficult for them to see that top line revenue growth that they're desiring over the next couple of years if they don't have the initiative to really underscore a product line that either they're planning to roll out or a product line that they feel is underperforming now because of either lack of marketing or lack of pushing on L Brand's part.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we finish this week's podcast, as we always finish our weekly Retail Focus podcast, by discussing a story or two that we're looking ahead to in the weeks or months to come. And Leighton, we'll begin with yours.
Yeah, so you saw a stock we've talked about for quite some time, a company, an Office Depot, as they reported their third quarter earnings. And honestly, this was quite surprising. They came in with a profit that totaled $44 million, topping analyst expectations, despite having sales fall 7% to $2.84 billion. billion dollars for the quarter. However, if you do look a little deeper into their earnings release, a $240 million tax credit helped to benefit the company, and it really looked to offset the lower revenue they were bringing in from the lesser amount of locations that they have here in the U.S. I was a little bit surprised digging through this earnings release. They only closed 7 stores for their third quarter. They had talked previously about their initiatives to close over 300 stores. This in addition to a couple hundred stores they have already closed here in the U.S. since their merger with Office Max. But they currently have a total of about 1,500 stores, and they're looking to shut down about 65 in the fourth quarter. So they are expanding that effort to get to that 300 mark sooner than later. So positive signs from Office Depot. However, there wasn't much as far as a forward-looking strategy for the company. They were mainly just focused on how all of these divestitures would help with the cash on the balance sheet. They were saying that they still plan to sell off their European business, and they were hoping to close it by the end of 2016, and that they said the board had also approved the selling of the majority of their international businesses, the remaining businesses, which generate approximately $600 million in annual sales. However, most of these locations overseas do have an operating loss. So this is going to be good, again, for their income statement. However, it's going to be interesting considering their asset base is going to be significantly smaller in the future. So one really has to wonder, with a reduced store count here in the U.S. and almost no international locations in the next couple of years, what is going to be the future for Office Depot? But we will wait and we will see.
So the stories I'm looking ahead to have to do with teen and young adult retailers in the holiday season. We'll begin with Aeropostale, where it was announced this week that actually more Aeropostale locations than previously thought were profitable. And as a result, Simon, which purchased a large stake in Aeropostale during their bankruptcy proceedings earlier this year, has kept 500 of their overall 700 stores open. So things looking pretty promising for Aeropostale in that a lot of their locations were actually in the black, and it was either accounting errors or some other irregularities that had kept them from showing that on the balance sheets. Meanwhile, bad news in another area of teen and young adult retail, where after bankruptcy restructuring from American Apparel, it was announced this week by the New York Post that they may not make it through the holidays. A lot of negative things coming from American Apparel. The article in the New York Post suggests that the company may choose to move to a different location outside of its urban Los Angeles location, where they manufacture a good number of the clothes that they sell. So you have, on the plus side, Aeropostale being a little bit more profitable than was once thought. And then on the negative side, American Apparel hemorrhaging away sales, hemorrhaging away money as they go, and they may have to move soon or risk shutting down their entire location. I'll be watching them and other similar retailers like American Eagle, for example, to see how teen retailers do in what can be sometimes a make or break holiday season for those businesses right there on the cusp of sustainability and viability, or on the other end, bankruptcy.
It's interesting when you look at the history of these companies. So to just quickly put it in perspective, Aeropostale had over 800 stores at its peak. And then if you look at American Apparel, the company was ranked part of the top 500 growing companies in the United States. And this was just 11 years ago. So it's interesting to see how quickly fashion can change and how it really affects the bottom line of these companies, and how companies that get so big in terms of sales growth can really diminish very quickly.
Well, that'll do it for this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. Make sure and follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast, as Layton posts all of the regular retail news throughout the week. Be sure and check out our Food Focus edition on Friday. We'll talk a little bit of retail there too, including Michigan-based superstore retailer Meijer and their growing market share that they're seeing in terms of craft spirits. We'll also discuss Nutella. That's right, Nutella, and how they may be adjusting nutrition facts labels with the FDA's blessing. For Layton, I'm Trent. So long, until next time.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.